What if you were born with a disease that you always knew would kill you? And then what if all of a sudden you were given a second chance? Well, that's exactly what happened to me. And it's the question that we explore on the new podcast series, Breathless, from Snack Labs. Join me, Jeremy Saunders, for a series that explores what it means to live and die, to love and to lose, and what it's like to have your whole life turned upside down and the unexpected challenges that come with a life-saving drug. You can listen to Breathless now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Good morning, everyone. It is 7 o'clock here in Podcast Land, Canada. Joined by a very special guest today. It's the guy who has 2 weeks to put these episodes together and still leaves it to the last minute. Self-proclaimed mental health advocate, Kyle Moore. Let's hear it for Kyle.
Hi, it's awful to be here.
Awful to have you.
Can I just say hi to the people back home real quick?
The people you live with? Your parents? Yeah, for sure.
Hi, Mom and Dad.
Must be busy.
Yeah. Something like that.
So why do you procrastinate so long in making these things?
Well, see, thank you, Kyle. I'm what people would call the worst. So I do the whole I work better under pressure thing. That's like the type that I say that I am.
Sounds like some pride to me.
You'd probably be right.
The 100% effort in the last hour so you don't fail during the 2 weeks leading up to the episode.
Okay, relax. Mr. Mind Reader over here. I think that I can just do anything. You know, you see?
I do see.
Yeah. And now, is it true that despite or maybe because you're a big hard-o podcaster, you don't ask for the intro suggestions until the last minute?
Yes, that is correct.
Didn't ask anyone.
No.
Oops. What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, who honestly, like between you and me, has really grown into his looks, Kyle Moore. And joining me as always, the co-host who just goes everywhere with me, the personification of my mental illness, also me.
As always, just a pleasure to be here. Question before we start, though.
No, I haven't seen 127 hours.
See, I didn't think you had because it took us so fucking long to get that intro done. You know, you guys don't see the back end stuff, you know, like the work at home, but Lord, when you throw a curveball with a pop culture reference,
I crumble.
You really do.
Mr. Mental Health and Pop Culture all tapped in and I get a suggestion like this, which is incredible, by the way, because I love a challenge. And time just starts to like slip away, and not everyone can pull off James Franco interviewing himself.
And you are living proof of that, my friend. It was a fun one, though. And shout out to our listener, Alex, for giving us the idea. Follow her on Instagram, at AlexKV. That is AlekSKV. And if you want to get a shout out on the podcast, have a little bit of fun, you know, an idea brought to life. All you have to do is follow us on Instagram, at Life's Direct Podcast.
Or at Morrissey.
Yes, or at Morzy, and answer our question box leading up to the episode. We'll make it a reality show you out on the pod. Just a little win-win.
Fun stuff over here at Life's a Wreck. Just bunch of fun. And speaking of fun stuff, this episode of Life's a Wreck is brought to you by our friends at Tether, the men's peer support social network that we're a part of and honestly have really benefited from.
It's a community of men who just get it.
Yeah, so download Tether in the App Store or Google Play Store today and start connecting. Man, I know that we have like this the next thing up on the list, but I'm really excited for this episode today because we've got a pretty cool announcement to make regarding the Better Tomorrow merch that we dropped for the podcast.
Yeah, because of your guys' support, Life's a Wreck Media is hella f***ing proud to donate $200 to the Maddie Murphy Memorial Fund, a charity that was chosen by Lexi Dakin's family. It's a local memorial fund here in New Brunswick, and we're just really happy to be able to do our part in supporting that.
Starting in a few months, Better Tomorrow is going to be like its own standalone clothing line. And honestly, we just look forward to being able to continue to further the dialogue surrounding mental health and provide support to incredible mental health charities, while also just being able to provide you guys with some pretty fucking dope clothes.
Yeah, 22 years old, by the time you started dressing yourself.
Huh. That kind of sounds like an Instagram caption.
I am the one with the creative juice.
Yeah. My inspiration. Yeah,
don't forget it.
Yeah, I literally can't.
So. That's a good point.
This week on the podcast, guys, I'm so excited to share this platform with my new friend, author, and someone who honestly within the mental health space I very much look up to, Andrew Reiner. Andrew is a professor at Townsend University where he offers the seminar Changing Face of Masculinity. He has written on masculinity and men's issues for the New York Times, Italy's La Repubblica.
Solid accent.
Thank you. The Washington Post magazine, and his work has been featured on NPR, CBC, The Guardian, Men's Health magazine, and Forbes. He speaks about masculinity regularly at schools, conferences, nationally, internationally. He's also the author of one of my favorite books, Better Boys, Better Men, which led me to his incredible work and got him on the podcast. So, Andrew, thank you so much for being here, man. Welcome to the podcast. How you doing?
Well, thank you for asking, Kyle. Andrew Reiner is completely overwhelmed. Mm. I have been dealing with a friend who's got an aggressive form of early onset dementia. It's called frontotemporal. Mm-hmm. And it has been beyond overwhelming the past 2 years. But this week in particular, he's been in the hospital because he started getting delusional. And so we've got to find like another facility for him and another life for him. And it's been on my shoulders because I'm power of attorney. So I have been, I haven't been experiencing a lot of highs this week. It's been a lot of lows and a lot of tough times. Honestly, I'm in a rough place, man. I really am. I'm in a very tough place. It's been just one of those weeks at the end of the day, you just feel like you've just been in a couple fights, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of like, it is almost exhausting in my own life. That's what I find. It's that sense of drained and just, oh my God, do I ever want to break?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the one thing that has been helping me tremendously, and I never really could give it a chance before, is doing affirmations. Mm. It's something that never really, I always understood it like intellectually, but it was the kind of thing that never worked for me, you know?
Yeah.
I was always too skeptical.
Right.
And I always thought, I'm great, glad it works for you, but man, it doesn't sit with me. Mm-hmm. And so over the past couple weeks, I've been just really kind of facing up to some big shifts and changes that I want and need in my life. You know, as you probably know, sometimes you've got to start to get close to bottom before you're really willing to start looking at things in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I am. You know, I'm kind of at a place where, you know, things need to shift.
Yeah.
And it always has to happen from within.
Mm. I would hate to say that it's refreshing to hear what you like, how you're doing, to be honest. And I know that that's one of those things. Usually you want somebody to say, oh, I'm doing great. I've had the best week ever. Yeah. It's been cool, but it is. Cause I think that, you know, we had just talked about right before I hit the recording button that there's been a lot going on in my own community that's really taken a lot out of all of us. And that idea of hitting like bottom being a place to kind of reevaluate, I think is an interesting one, because for us, like, we have had an opportunity here in New Brunswick with the passing of this young girl in our community, Lexi, to reevaluate like how we as a province view mental health and healthcare. And it's really brought around some really important questions. And I think that that's one of those things where from this rock bottom, sometimes, and I've always said this throughout the podcast and throughout everything, from rock bottom can be a really great place to build a foundation. So I think that that's interesting that you touched on that as well. I think it's really cool.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm a huge believer in the idea of the generative force and power of rock bottom, because, you know, in the States, for instance, one of the things we haven't done, despite all of the, you know, the huge issues with Black Lives Matter and the racism, the conversation is still in a lot of ways stuck. And I really do believe that, you know, when you hit rock bottom, that's an unexpected open door.
Yeah.
That's the time you want to start, you know, that you really want to take advantage of that and start having the hard, necessary conversations, whether it's with yourself or with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love the idea of, when you're at rock bottom, that idea of it can't get any worse. I think that's what I love. And I think that there's so much freedom once you kind of say, well, literally I'm at this low point. It's not like anything I can do will make any of this worse. And so I remember that was something that I found really profound in my own mental health journey, was when I was at that rock bottom, I was like, well, I might as well go see a therapist, because why not? It can't get any worse. And then that kind of set me on a good track. So sometimes rock bottom can be a very beautiful thing, for sure.
Oh, it absolutely can be, you know, and it's an opportunity for redemption, which is huge.
Yeah.
It is a huge opportunity, both from within and from without, for redemption.
I love that. That's great. So, you know, speaking of redemption, you know, this idea of the way that we talk and we look at men in regards to mental health and in society today, this has been something that after reading your book, which, you know, for anybody who's listening, you have to go pick up Better Boys, Better Men. Really incredible read, an easy read as well, like one that I decide, like, just burned through in a couple, like, a week, because I found that with everything that you were talking about, with every point, it was a little bit of that, like, every page you flipped, you're like, yeah, I get that. As a man, I get, like, I understand this. And it's right. And it's so universal. And so, I mean, I'm kind of curious, and I'd love for you to share with my listeners just kind of like why you decided to study men, like why this interest in the culture surrounding men.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, for me, it really begins when I'm about 7 years old. And, you know, I get into this in my neighborhood, what was a very atypically brutal fight. In my neighborhood, we had fights. They were over in a few minutes and they were never
bad.
Like
little scraps. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a scrap. You never really were trying to, like, you know, beat the hell out of the other child. And so there was this kid who was about a year younger than me. Maybe he was I think actually we were the same age. He was like a grade behind me. But anyway, we're about seven and we get into this fight and it just drags on. It becomes this brutal fight. And it becomes one of these unusual fights in that all the kids in the neighborhood come running out when they hear about it. You know, kids are like knocking at each other's doors. You've got to see this fight.
Right.
Because nobody really
it's
ever
the main
seen
event.
Oh, yeah. Nobody, because this thing went on. And it got to the point where, you know, he, you know, tells me to get on my knees and beg for mercy. I mean, this kind of sadism wasn't the kind of thing that ever happened in our neighborhood. We joked around about things like that, but we never said things or did things like that to each other in a fight.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm getting broken down and I do it. And he still keeps hitting me. Mm. And at one point I get up and I run away, you know, because the fight has been going on so long, I'm bloodied up and pummeled. You know, I run away, he still catches up to me and starts hitting me. And I remember at one point, you know, one of the things that's a really unusual experience about being a human and experiencing trauma is that for some reason, when we're in the middle of something, no matter how quickly it happens, time seems to slow down, you know, in that moment, remember small things. I remember before I got up and ran away, because I just had to get away from this just brutal beating.
Absolutely.
I remember looking around at the kids around me, you know, and their mouths were just open. I remember that their eyes, they were wide eyed. Their mouths were open because we had seen things like this, you know, maybe on TV, but we'd never seen anything like this, in real person in the neighborhood. And so eventually I find my way home that day. You know, I spend time by myself behind an azalea bush to get away from everyone and everything. And I'm just traumatized, man, bloodied, you know, crying, just completely, you know, in this kind of moment of you're just, you can't even think straight. You're just so overwhelmed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like survival instinct kind of kicks in.
Completely. Yeah. That's why I literally was like a dog. I just found a place to sit by myself and just, you know, try to lick my wounds. You know, eventually I get home and I walk through the back door and I hear my oldest brother screaming at the top of his lungs. And I'm thinking, okay, he's pissed off. He's going to like stand up for me in some way.
Yeah.
And he's yelling at my mother. And I just hear him saying, what a coward, what a black sheep, what an embarrassment to the family. And he was talking about me.
Wow.
And my mother really didn't say much to really counter what he was saying. She just kind of listened and let him kind of burn out, you know, the heat a little bit. And she just said something to the effect of, well, you know, I'm sure this is something he'll grow out of. Mm-hmm. So even though I didn't intellectually think to myself, wow, my mother's not really coming to my aid here.
Yeah.
On an emotional level, even as a kid, you pick up, there's no support.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing too, about being a young kid is like, you'd be amazed how much stuff you just absorb. You know, we always say that kids are sponges. And even if it's not something that you're cognitively aware of, I mean, half the time I've been in therapist's office and I've said something and they're like, do you think that stems from, you know, when your dad or your mom or like this, maybe they let, you know, like, oh my God. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
No, like, where did that come from? Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's exactly it. And you're right. And kids don't get it intellectually, but they get it where it hits harder, which is emotionally.
Yeah.
And so they know on some level that they're not really being protected. And so that smear campaign really that my brother started that day, you know, just really just took off. And he, you know, that became, you know, the story for my brother with me for decades, well into like probably my late 20s, early 30s.
Wow.
You know, everything, every excuse that he found to make fun of me or to deride me was something about me being cowardly, always.
Right.
And it wasn't just me. I mean, he, you know, he looked for ways in our family to demean and to, you know, to verbally, you know, pick on the other siblings as well.
Right.
But for me, what happened was, you know, at 7, 8 years old, I'm looking for fights.
Yeah.
And what I didn't realize until much, much, much later is I'm basically trying to fight my way out of the shame.
Totally. Yeah. Prove yourself.
So I do that for years. And I always do this at school. I mean, I still got into fights in the neighborhood, but by and large, you know, I was looking for other places where that felt like I could do this without being judged. You know, my brother wasn't at school. My eldest brother wasn't at school. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for fights at school and I was successful. I found them. You know?
Well, if you go looking for a fight, usually you can find one.
Not that I want them, but man, the fights are not hard to find if you're looking for
them.
And so I spent a lot of time doing that. Right. And I remember one of my teachers one year, I must have been in like second or third grade, but she would give me like a big candy bar at the end of each week if I didn't get into fight.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just that bad, that young. So I was just getting into fights constantly and not constantly, but a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was in like sixth grade, I get into this fight with this kid on the playground. And I remember really, really feeling, you know, being aware of my fist connecting with his jaw.
Yeah.
And that feeling just reverberated like throughout my body. I mean, it suddenly just kind of dawned on me. You know, I was doing something I hated doing. I hated fighting. It made me nauseous. You know, I didn't want to be doing this.
Right.
And so, you know, once I finally unclenched my fists, literally and figuratively, it kind of opened up the space for me to start looking around and looking at the ways, the cruel ways often you know, that boys treat each other, the way we talk to each other, the way we don't talk to each other, you know, the things we do as well. And so it kind of opened up a consciousness for me that I was really avoiding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everything shifted after that. Everything shifted. Suddenly I am like aware of things on my radar.
Right.
That I've been avoiding looking at for all this time, or that or that I didn't even need to be aware of, you know? And so, you know, I'm looking at things, you know, I'm seeing that, you know, in the locker room during gym class,
you know,
certain guys are suddenly like really riding other guys really hard for the stupidest of things. You know, I'm looking at, you know, when we're playing sports, the way that guys are trash talking to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't know exactly what about it bothered me. I just knew it felt really wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just knew on a very visceral level, this feels wrong. I don't know why, but I cannot buy into this anymore. I can't do it anymore.
That's interesting and powerful that you had that realization at a young age, though, because I feel like so many, especially men, go through their whole lives and they kind of just like discount everything as, well, that's just how life is, or that's just how guys are, or that's just how whatever, right? And so that's interesting that at that young age, after being immersed within this very, you could, you know, call it that toxic masculinity culture and that, like, that anger and that fighting the shame, that you were able to take that step back after that moment and say, it's not just me, I'm seeing a lot of guys doing the same kind of stuff, and that's just feels wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I got to tell you, man, I felt like a pariah for a long time because, you know, I'm wondering, like on the one hand, I just don't feel like I just fit in.
Yeah.
And yet on the other hand, the thing that saved me, that really helped my inner compass, was that I was a mirror image in many ways of my oldest brother. I was, you know, just as big feelings, you know, just as feisty, you know, just as quick, you know, to really kind of just clench my fist. But I decided at a young age, even when I was still fighting, I didn't know it at that time, but I realized that I really, no, actually it was after I was fighting, when I started opening my eyes, I realized that I wanted to push back against everything he was about. And I wasn't consciously aware of that, but I did that. That's when I started opening my eyes and paying attention. And I was going to just put everything I had of me into pushing back against everything I hated about him. Because he represented the worst impulses of masculinity. He really did. And I was going to go at it with everything I had against everything people like, guys like he represented.
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Well, I was going to say, how did that start? I mean, what was that kind of first step along this journey, this crusade that you've been on? Because if you recognize it at such a young age, I'm just curious, like if it was starting a group at school or if it was just talking to people, like when did you actually start doing that physical work within the space?
That's a great question, Kyle. So, you know, it wasn't conscious. You know, this was not conscious. I was just kind of undertaking it in my own little small way. You know, this wasn't becoming, you know, a kind of crusade where I was trying to, enlist other people. I was just kind of plodding along, you know, and I was just thinking, you know, I'm opening my eyes and looking at ways of talking and behaving that just sickened me, really. And I thought, you know, I didn't have that kind of bigger perspective of I want to affect change on a large scale.
Right.
It was, I'm just trying to get by day to day. I'm trying to survive, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't understand, you know, why this is all happening. All I know is it feels wrong to me, and I trust that it feels wrong to me. One of the first things I remember doing was being in the locker room in gym class during seventh grade. And there was this kid, Benjamin Berry. He was like one of the few kids at that age who like actually had biceps, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Like who works out in seventh grade?
Yeah. I know every gym class has one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's this kid, Benjamin Berry. And he lines up three of us, you know, and he tells us, you know, all the things that, you know, he's like giving us orders, things to do.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm not doing it.
Mm.
He said, what do you mean you're not doing it? I said, what you're doing is wrong. I don't remember the exact words, but something to the effect of, I'm not doing this. You're bullying us.
Yeah.
This is not okay, man. This is not okay. If you want to hit me, go ahead and hit me.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, I'm just telling you right now, I'm not doing this. You guys shouldn't be doing it either. And so it just kind of diffused.
Right. Oh, it diffused.
I wasn't looking, you know, I wasn't looking for ways, like I said, to enlist other people. I wasn't
right,
there yet.
Yeah.
But I just knew that I couldn't stand up for this shit. This was not okay.
Right.
You know, and so I was basically just kind of going from like day to day. I was always kind of in survival mode anyway, but I was just kind of going day to day, you know, and when things did happen, that pushed back. When things did happen, that definitely reminded me of what I was dealing with at home with my brother.
Yeah.
I just knew out there, I wasn't having any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was basically going from like day to day experience to experience, just saying, drawing boundaries and saying, this is not okay. You know, what you're doing, you know, maybe it was also something I remember sitting at the lunch table with friends, you know, and I was always really into sports, always played sports,
nice.
But I hated talking about them. And so we'd sit there and I'd say, I don't feel like talking about the game.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to talk about the game?
Right.
There's other things to talk about. What do you want to talk about? Well, she is beautiful. That girl sitting at the table over there. Do you know anything about her? She's beautiful. I would love to meet her.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it was, I didn't want to sit around and do what guys always did, which was just sit around and talk about sports.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and so it was really small, little, you know, trivial things like that.
Yeah.
That were really just kind of raising my own consciousness.
Mm-hmm. As you went and as you kind of subconsciously were calling out these behaviors in day-to-day life, I was really intrigued when you said that Benjamin Barry, that when you stood up to him, that it de-escalated the situation. Because from what I've seen a lot within kind of society, and especially the rhetoric that's been going on through social media over the past couple of years, is that a lot of the times when now men are kind of... men are challenged in a very immediate way to look very critically at the lives that they've grown up with, at how they're the culture that they've created or that has been created by their grandparents or their fathers or their uncles or anything like that. And I find that a lot of men are really pushing back on that. So I was really surprised to hear that Benjamin Barry, like he took that step back. As you've started doing your work, how have you found it's been received by men?
So the, you know, the response has been not surprisingly mixed. A lot of, you know, a lot of men, I'd say, you know, late 40s, 50s, have said to me, you know, some guys have said, you know, I like it, but even a lot of guys who consider themselves, you know, pretty enlightened guys who are older, like, you know, middle age, upper middle age, have really, they told me they've seen a lot of their own experiences in the book. But they really, they haven't exactly told me what, but there's parts about it that, you know, that they may not be completely on board with, because if they were on board with it, I know they would have told me that. I think what is happening with a lot of men is that it's pushing their buttons, which is good, because the buttons that I'm trying to push after years of being in this space of working towards healthy masculinity and researching and writing about this for the past 5 or 6 years, I think I have a pretty good sense of where we need to be headed. And so when I hear guys saying, I couldn't get through the book, or, you know, I saw a lot of myself in there, to me, that's code for, you know, it was pushing parts of me that made me uncomfortable.
Right.
And as we were talking about before, about hitting bottom, that's a place, that's a generative place to come from. That's a place of possibility and change. That's a place that's hard, but that's where you work from if you're really going to affect any kind of change and growth.
Right.
And so I don't begrudge any man who reads it and can't get through it. I was interviewing a guy about 2 weeks ago who's in his mid-30s. He's a young dad. And he said to me, you know, I was reading your book and I just had to put it down even when I was at the introduction. I couldn't keep going.
Wow.
And I said, do you mind telling me why?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, because I just saw too much of myself in the book.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing I've noticed for a lot of older men, but I'm not surprised that some younger men too, you know, but by and large, with men, some of the younger men, the response has been more like much more receptive and much more able to see the value in what it is that I'm really kind of aiming for.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, if I was just to kind of draw my own rough conclusion on why that would be, just as a young man who's read the book and really resonated with a lot of it, but couldn't put it down, kind of like the opposite of it. I think that like we've been really fortunate to grow up where it's like this new age of this emphasis on mental health, this new age of masculinity, this very socially conscious culture has kind of like, I feel like it has helped this newer generation of man a little bit kind of come to grips more, I guess, more easily with like, okay, that's a healthy example of masculinity. And even though that might not mirror my own life, I understand that like these are elements that like would benefit me to align with. Versus a lot of other men who might be in the older generation, kind of, it is one of those things where it's like, it's that, can you teach an old dog new tricks? I've been living my whole life this way. It's worked out really well for me up to this point. And now all of a sudden you're telling me that I'm a bad person, or they're feeling attacked because it's like, hey, you guys were part of this masculinity group and now we're looking at this masculinity group. And I think that can be tough for some older people to process, for sure.
It is. To give you a really good example of that, there's a gentleman that I interviewed, his name is Paul, and he was in the chapter I begin in the book about men and their relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually is a pretty staggering story because Paul is this lawyer. He's like 60 years old and he's a really thoughtful guy. And he goes through this really, really profound transformation because he's divorced. He's been kicked out of his house. He's not seeing his kids nearly enough because his wife isn't really letting him see them. He's drinking way too much and he's in this apartment and he's in a really, like really probably the lowest point in his life, he told me. And so there's this vertical beam in his like living room.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, typically, you know, fairly drunk one night, really down and just incredibly, he doesn't know why he does this. Of course, we can all figure it out when we're reading it, but he goes over and he just ends up hugging the hell out of this beam.
Mm-hmm.
And he's having this thought while he's doing it, you know, that, you know, this is pathetic as hell.
Right.
I'm completely disgusted with myself right now.
Right.
And yet something about this feels oddly helpful and really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so he ends up doing it again. And he ends up doing it again. And he ends up doing it again. So Paul ends up going through this transformation of realizing that all the relationships in his life, you know, the men that he's close to, he's just really not getting what he needs. He needs something more. But here's the thing. Even though Paul needs this physical touch, and he needs to be talking about things beyond just sports, he can only really take it so far. Because when I follow up with him throughout, over the course of like a 2-year period, I did it throughout the book when I was researching the book. You know, Paul eventually like found a trivia group to go out and do, which was great. That was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I'd say to him, well, so, you know, what about these guy friends you told me about that you could talk with that go back to your college days? Well, you know, I can still talk with them. Well, so what does that look like? And often what it looked like was Paul, you know, doing what I call targeted transparency.
Mm-hmm.
There were certain things he felt safe sharing, some things he didn't. He would pick and choose what he shared, and often he would be getting like advice or solutions.
Yeah.
Right? Typical, right?
Yes.
About how to handle the problem.
Yeah. What's the fix?
Well, yeah. And so, okay, Paul, so what is it like? Like, do you ever get emotional support? Well, I just told you I got support from them, but do you get emotional support?
Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, that's like, you know, I'll get that from my girlfriend. So this is the kind of thing that even when some guys think they're getting it, actually they're really not.
Mm-hmm.
And there were younger men that I would interview, guys who were like in high school and college. I'd say the same question. So where do you guys get your emotional support? I've got a couple of close guy friends. What does it look like when you talk to them? Almost always, Kyle, it was a matter of getting advice and solutions to problems that they didn't feel like they could or should be going to anybody else for, because they should be doing it on their own, right?
Yeah.
But rarely were they ever getting the kind of emotional support that they could get from females in their lives.
So I would love if you could give an example or more of like a definition as to the difference between going and just talking about, hey, here's the problem I have, offer up some solutions, and emotional support.
Right. So they look similar on the surface to a lot of guys, especially because we conflate the two. We really do. If we are getting help from another guy, they care about us.
Right.
I.e. their ergo, that is emotional support, but it's not. When a lot of guys go to females in their lives, be they friends, be they girlfriends, be they partners, be they wives, they're venting, and what they're really hoping to get back, often more than advice, is they want somebody to say, this really sucks. This must be really hard.
Yeah.
This, wow, you're really in a tough place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would you like a hug?
Mm-hmm.
These are examples of the kind of things that so many females have been culturally raised to do. It's just implicit to their being. But this can and is part of the being of those of us who are males, because we can easily learn to do this if we weren't raised this way.
Right.
We can.
Yeah.
You know, we see it constantly in men's groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a coincidence that we're seeing, you know, this burgeoning rise of men's groups right now. And in men's groups, men are learning to practice this and to do this in ways. And it's fine if it's behind closed doors, because a lot of them really are ashamed of this. And it's really this kind of, you know, this kind of new ground they're covering, that they're still trying to figure out how to be this way with another guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what it looks like. You know, it looks like something as simple as, I'm here for you.
Yeah.
I'm here to just listen.
Yeah.
Something as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
Something as simple as saying, wow, that must be really hard, and leaving it at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or something like, would you like a hug?
Right. Yeah. And it's funny you say that. And I know we're getting close to the time. So I got two more questions for you. But I wanted to share real quick, because I know that the people who are listening and who just heard that, I've talked about it on the podcast before, and I believe that we had talked about it as well on a previous call. But the moment that really changed my life as a young man with mental health was going, I had been to a few therapists before, had never really resonated with anybody that I was with. And so I always thought that, man, therapy is not my thing. It's not for me. I was one of those people who had that mindset that, oh, I don't need to go to therapy. I've tried it three times, versus like seeing it as that dating process where you go and you meet new people and you see who you connect with. But I finally went to a therapist when I was a Ryerson student in Toronto. And I went to this therapist, and she said, okay, tell me what's going on. And so I gave her this spiel that I'd given to every other therapist I'd ever been to. And I remember she sat in silence for a few seconds. And it was one of the first times in my life that I'd opened up to somebody and they hadn't tried to give me a quick fix. And I assumed that that's what therapists were.
Right.
I thought that they were supposed to say, I'm saying, here's my problems. Give me the answer. And she sat there silently for a few minutes. And I remember I was very awkward, and I was sitting there and I'm like, why hasn't she said anything? Like, what the hell is going on? And I was kind of getting uncomfortable. I was like fidgeting in my seat. I'm like, should I go? Like, what's going on? And she just looked at me and she goes, you know what? Sounds really hard. And I remember just like sitting, kind of sinking back into my seat. And I was like, wow, it's been like 15 years of pressure just, you know, boiling me down and really kind of condensing me. And then all of a sudden I've got this human being who I don't know, who heard my experiences and just validated that it's shitty and that it's tough. And I was like, and it was this breath of fresh air. And it did. It put me on a much better path. Just that one, like you said, when you were a kid and you had that thing just click. It was like I had that same thing. That just moment happened. That light bulb went off. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah, this is hard. And it's like, that's okay for this to be hard. I don't have to fight against that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. And that's what, you know, we need permission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, boys and men need to give each other much more permission, A, to be able to feel the things that we're told we're not supposed to fear, feel, but we are okay to fear them.
Mm-hmm.
And we also need to give, you know, them permission to know. Boys and men also need permission to know that another boy or man can meet them where they are emotionally.
Right.
Because we really, on a very subtle level, we just, the way that we're socialized together, we don't give that kind of permission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I've ever had another guy say to me, wow, what you're going through is really shitty.
Yeah.
I feel for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I've ever had another guy say that.
Right.
And yet I've sat there, you know, with female therapists, with women, mm-hmm. who have no problem going there.
Yeah. Yeah, because it does. It just seems more effortless. Yeah, it's just that, of course, like, that's hard.
Yeah, right. Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's like the most normal thing in the world to say.
Right.
But it's this idea that, you know, in so many levels, you know, we're taught at a young age and throughout our lives that we don't have permission mm-hmm. when it comes to those parts of our lives. We don't have permission to really integrate those seemingly negative feelings mm-hmm. with the rest of our being.
Right.
Whereas so many women just know this is the most normal thing in the world.
Yeah.
It sucks sometimes and it's hard, but it's normal. It's part mm-hmm. of being human.
Yeah.
And we don't give each other permission to experience those feelings in any real meaningful way. And then to also, you know, bear witness to it mm-hmm. and to validate it.
Amazing. Okay. So these last two questions, the first one I want to ask, and I think that it kind of bleeds from that answer into this. But at the end of every episode, I like to give my listeners a challenge, something that they can implement in their day, their week, their month, their life, something that will help them live a more fulfilled, happy life. And I would love if in particular, you could put forth a challenge to the men who are listening to this episode, for something that they can do that you've learned in your years of looking at this interesting life of man, a challenge that you'd put forth to any of the male listeners.
Absolutely. So I'd have two challenges, one for somebody that you know pretty well mm-hmm. and for one that who's a complete stranger. Mm-hmm. For the person in your life, for a boy or a man that you know really well, you know, when you see that look on that boy or man's face, that you can tell for just a moment that they're stricken, mm-hmm. that they're feeling a little bit vulnerable. Ask them if they're okay. Mm. Ask them if they're okay. Ask them if it's anything that you know that they'd like to talk about. Mm-hmm. Ask them if they need a hug. Mm. You know, we know when people need help. We can mm-hmm. tell that stricken look in somebody's face, right. The eyes giving away, right?
Yeah.
But just for that one moment, you know, whatever you're comfortable with, ask that person if they're okay. At the very least, ask them, are you okay? Mm-hmm. If you're not okay, is there anything I can do to help? Mm-hmm. Even something as simple as that, you know, or ask them if, you know, if there's any, you know, if they want to talk about it, or ask them if they need a hug with mm-hmm. somebody who's a complete stranger. If you're out and you see a guy who, you know, looks like he could use a little help, he probably could use a little help. Hmm. And with guys, we always think, you know, one of two things: either I'm sure he's fine and I don't want to embarrass him, mm. which it within in and of itself is a problem, mm-hmm. but I don't want to embarrass him because, you know, he's a guy and I'm sure, you know, he's going to feel really offended, or I don't want to, like, you know, intrude. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. A lot of guys, I don't want to intrude. Try to push beyond that, because that's really, both of those reflexive thoughts are really underpin a lot of the problems that we perpetuate for ourselves and for other men. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of the problem. And so try to get beyond, put those aside and just go up to a guy and say, hey man, you know, can I give you a hand? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, just, hey, is everything all right?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to intrude, but, you know, just, is everything cool? Are you mm-hmm. all right? Is there anything I can do? If not, just give me the word. But I just wanted to let you know, I see something and I just, I'm here to help. If you see a guy, you know, in a grocery store, you know, knocking over a display of cans, you know, don't even say anything. Just go over and help him pick up the cans.
Yeah.
If he wants to react and say, hey, I've got this, that's cool. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing that we don't often realize about reaching out to people. While as men, we are taught to reflexively push back and to let people know that we've got this all under control because mm-hmm. that's our competency. At the end of the day, that person is going to be in his car or he's going to be walking into his apartment. And on some level, he's going to think, that was really nice. Mm-hmm. That even though I didn't want the help, somebody was there for me.
Right.
Everybody needs to know. I've been in this tough place, man. You're catching me when I'm wrong.
Oh, dude, I get I get it.
Everybody needs to know somebody's got our back. Everybody needs to know that even a stranger, in some ways it feels even more powerful when it's a stranger.
Absolutely.
Somebody's got our back out there.
Yeah.
That makes a huge difference at the end of the day, whether we admit it at that time or not. On a deep level, we feel good that somebody at least asked.
I love that. I think that's beautiful. I think that idea of everyone needs to know that somebody has your back. I think that one definitely resonates. I think that hits pretty close to home here too, with everything that my community's dealt with over the past little bit. So yeah, thank you, man. I think that that's a beautiful challenge. The last question that I want to ask you is simply, what was your favorite part of writing the book, and how can people get their hands on Better Boys, Better Men?
Yeah. Oh, thank you for asking. My favorite part of writing the book, there were two parts of it. One of the favorite parts was definitely in the writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the analysis. Great. I just love sitting down and trying to make sense of all this. Mm-hmm. The other part of it was interviewing the men and the boys. I love being in conversation, and that was
me too.
I just love being in conversation, and it was just, you know, the give and the take, you know, and helping people figure things out sometimes for themselves that they hadn't really thought about before.
That's amazing. I love that.
It was a gift.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your writing has been a gift to so many. So I want to thank you. I mean, just on behalf of men who have dealt with some really kind of getting caught up in just being a man, and the tangles that can ensue. Thank you for the work that you've done, because it is very impactful, in more ways than you know. So thank you for the book. Thank you for just being yourself. Andrew Reiner, a beautiful man and a beautiful author. So make sure to pick up Better Boys, Better Men. And Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me on. You're doing great work, Kyle.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff, man.
Yeah, this episode, I think, sums up what I was hoping Life's a Wreck would become really well. Like, this idea of two men of different generations can show themselves to be vulnerable and in need of support on a public platform. And yet at the end of the day, just because a man asked for help or a hug, like Andrew said, or to have space to let some tears fall, like, it doesn't make them less of a man or who they are. Like, Andrew is going to wake up tomorrow after this episode comes out, and he's still going to be a father and a partner and an incredible author. And I'm going to wake up tomorrow and still be a charismatic 22-year-old podcaster with great hair.
And bad breath.
Not going to let me have anything.
No. Okay? No.
All right, but you do know what I'm getting at here, right?
Yeah, definitely. No, I think this idea of men trying to fight to protect the character that they play is something that we see a lot. You know, like, why let people see the more intimate mental parts of your life? Because they might start to perceive you differently. And that would go against this public persona that you've created. And a lot of men see the structure of their lives built on this persona, this character, and not who they are as a human being. You know, it's who they are as a man, not who they are as themselves, if that makes sense.
Who they are as men, not who they are as themselves. That's some pretty, like, profound shit.
Don't know what to tell you. I'm a pretty profound guy.
That's great, man. And I think if this episode can carry any weight behind it at all, like, I can say from personal experience, the freedom that I've given myself by not letting that internal struggle control my life has changed everything for me. Like, as a man, I'm more confident. I can't be rattled by what people think about who I am or what I do or how I act or dress or walk or talk or f***ing whatever. Like, I'm my own worst critic. And once I started to work with that, and him, of course, like, I feel this level of freedom, and it's like, it's incredible. Like, it does. It feels like you're kind of, you know, you can take the world on. The only thing that you have to worry about is how you are going to handle the day-to-day. The other people's influences, it just doesn't matter anymore. This idea of traditional masculinity and the restraints, I guess, that it put on me for a long period of time in not talking about my mental health and not talking about the shit that was going on, like, that's gone. And I just feel fucking great. And I certainly hope that there are some men out there who listen to this and they see what Andrew have done and they see what the podcast is and they see what I've done and how this message has all been perceived. And there's always going to be people who are going to, like, fucking talk shit about you. That is a way of life. It is always going to happen. People who are going to question your manhood for doing this, that, and the other. But when you're secure in, and I don't say secure in that like insecure, secure way, but like, I mean like secure as in like you are grounded in who you are as a person. You are going to present an authentic, you're going to bear yourself, not this version of yourself that you think you have to present. It's a fucking amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. And I honestly, like, I think the perfect way to end this episode, masculinity is a wreck, life's a wreck, and fuck it, that's all from us. See you in 2 weeks.
It's a wreck.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.